Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 309 on the 4th of July, 2014. Greetings from Ocean Park, Maine, where I had planned to welcome you for the first time this summer with the sounds of the surf down by the beach. But alas, as I put this together, I was looking out at a driving rain, and that's still going tonight as I start the recording. And that means it was wiser to keep the Sony recorder indoors. I hope the weather clears up by tomorrow afternoon, Saturday, when the Ocean Park 4th of July parade will take place on July 5th. For the very first time after years of coming to this place in the summers, I'm going to be a participant in the parade. I'm going to show up for a 5-minute rehearsal that will equip me to be a member of the Kazoo Marching Band, and I will expect strong support from the family as I go by the corner of Temple and Seaside Avenues next to the Ocean Park soda fountain. My guest this week, I think, deserves strong support for his performance at an event that might have been titled Amazon Derangement Syndrome Live from New York. Blogger David P. Vandegrift was invited by Amazon to represent the company at a forum in New York City at the library. It was actually titled Amazon Business as Usual? Representing Hachette, for all intents and purposes, were all six of the other participants. But Passive Guy, as he refers to himself on the blog, did manage to give a very active defense of Amazon and indie authors.
Predatory pricing sounds good to people that don't really understand that law very well, but I don't see anything in Amazon's behavior that would support that.
In news, Forrester Research is out with a forecast of evaporating demand for dedicated e-readers like the Kindle Paperwhite, and I will also sip from the fire hose that is this week's internet coverage of Amazon versus Hachette. For the tech tip, I'm going to show you a way to skip the special offers sleep page on your Kindle Paperwhite without paying the $20 to remove special offers entirely, and I'll also point you toward a way to load free Google Play apps to your Kindle Fire. And in content, I'm going to highlight a promising source of mysteries for your summer reading. First up in news, today I happened on an item in The Australian that may be a bit of old news, but I've never seen it before. Chris Griffith, a Sydney-based tech journalist, in a post titled E-Readers, Wearables, Endangered Species, quoted friend of the podcast James McQuivy of Forrester Research as saying that the fall of dedicated e-readers will be, quote, just as pronounced and rapid as the rise of e-readers. And a rapid rise it has been, with more than 25 million people owning e-readers in 2012, just 5 years after the Kindle was introduced. The Forrester report cited appears to be one released in January of this year, available for purchase at the hefty price of $5,750. But the McQuivy interview was apparently done within the past month or so, because there's a reference in a quote of his to Apple's announced purchase of Beats Music. I emailed James this afternoon to try to find out more, but I haven't heard back from him. I hope he and his family are offline somewhere for a long holiday weekend. In any event, the Sydney journalist quotes the Forrester survey as predicting that the number of U.S. users of dedicated e-readers will fall from more than 25 million in 2012 to a mere 7 million by year-end 2016, just 3 years from now. The reason for the predicted steep decline is that e-reader functions are being absorbed by other devices, such as smartphones and tablets. McQuivy is quoted as noting that the digital era has witnessed the ascent and decline of a stunning number of new devices, and he adds, quote, unlike prior generations of tech, today's digital devices rapidly rise to tremendous heights and then are usurped or cast aside as consumers and manufacturers move to the next big thing. The e-reader's short lifespan as a dedicated device makes this clear, but many other devices, from the MP3 player to the flip camera, remember that one, it was a dedicated video camera, suffer from the same fate. this Forrester forecast does make sense to me, but I've also been struck by how passionately two Amazon senior vice presidents in recent interviews here on the Kindle Chronicles asserted that the company is committed to continued innovation and improvement of the e-ink Kindle platform. Russ Grandinetti, who heads content, and Dave Limp, who heads devices, both spoke with conviction on this point. I think it speaks to how books and the Kindle are not just another product for Amazon, a company founded on selling books and one whose founder and CEO is married to a successful novelist. McQuivey told The Australian that Forrester estimates global e-reader sales at 7.6 million in 2016, a level that would no longer drive new consumer behavior or spur technological innovation. Instead, McQuivey said, even Amazon will invest its dollars in newer, sexier devices like wearables, 3D printers, and drones, all as an effort to extend the Amazon relationship beyond the Kindle, the Fire TV, and the Amazon Dash. As I say, I think this is probably a likely scenario, but I don't think it means investment in Kindle improvements are going to fall off the map or be completely overlooked. Grandinetti and Limp seemed to indicate there are exciting improvements already in the pipeline for the e-ink Kindle, and I do expect to see some of them show up in new models this fall. But this article and McQuivey's quotes do indicate which way reading technology is probably trending over the, you know, not too distant term, and I feel a little sadness about it. It reminds me of the mixed feelings I felt at the end of the high-energy presentation of the first Kindle Fire nearly 3 years ago in New York City. Yes, there were impressive new Kindle e-readers introduced at that same event, but the star of the show was clearly the new tablet, and since then the growth of the tablet has been pretty dramatic compared to the e-ink devices. Now we've, of course, got the Fire Phone, a device that doesn't even have the name Kindle in it. If I keep doing this podcast for another 5 or 10 years, I suppose we'll maybe looking back at something called the Kindle with the sort of nostalgia that some of us now can summon for the Rocket Book. I wonder if I'll still be calling this the Kindle Chronicles then when the Kindle is something which is that far in the past. Oh, we'll see. I've got that Reading Edge name. I have still have the website for that. So yeah, I suppose if Kindle got to be sort of a dated name, I would just sashay over to the Reading Edge, which is a name that might outlast the Kindle. I don't think our reading is going to be any less interesting or any less enhanced by digital improvements. You know, we're going to see a better and better job of mimicking the brilliance of 500-year-old books on paper technology. Next in news, I have to say that the volume of writing about the Hachette versus Amazon negotiations is really becoming overwhelming, and most of the posts carry a trail of scores or hundreds of impassioned comments. It all gets a little predictable, but I still find it oddly compelling, as if we're all crowding around a sudden scuffle in the hallway at high school. The New York forum that you're going to hear about in the interview generated much of this week's Amazon versus Hachette reporting and pontificating, including an Associated Press piece carried by Jeff Bezos's newspaper, The Washington Post, that I think indicates that the Post editors are at this point feeling plenty of freedom to call him like they see him. The Post story was adorned by a big photo of Amazon nemesis James Patterson looking dapper in a tuxedo. It quoted David Vandegrift's statement that Amazon, quote, is entirely, completely focused on pleasing and delighting the millions of people who shop there. But the report adds, quote, a few groans were heard in the auditorium after that statement by David, which is a true statement, by the way. Just before the forum started, the Wall Street Journal's Jeffrey Trachtenberg, who has appropriately been covering the Hachette Amazon story as a business news story instead of a soap opera, published a piece that included a first-ever statement by an Amazon official. There had been an unattributed blog post at Amazon.com giving a similar explanation of Amazon's side of the story, but this was the first time that a reporter had a quote that actually was attached to the name of an Amazon executive. I'm glad to see this, actually, because I think in the absence of such comments, from Amazon. Amazon's foes have pretty much had the stage to themselves. You can find the Wall Street Journal article if you simply Google the headline, which is Amazon Defends Its Stance Against Hachette. Otherwise, the story will be hidden behind the paywall. Grandinetti declined to comment on the current state of negotiations with Hachette, of course. They're both under a non-disclosure agreement. But he did say Amazon is fighting for better prices for its customers. Quote, "This discussion is all about ebook pricing," Grandinetti said. "The terms under which we trade will determine how good the prices are that we can offer customers." He compared the current standoff with the one in 2011 when Amazon briefly removed the buy buttons from Macmillan titles, when Macmillan was demanding a shift to the agency model in which publishers set the prices of ebooks. Quote, "We were fighting for what we thought was best for customers, and the same is true here," Grandinetti said. In the article also, there's it's not a direct quote, but Trachtenberg says that Grandinetti indicated that they're aware that there's some damage being done to Amazon's reputation in the short term as they tough it out to get terms with Hachette that they believe are going to give them pricing flexibility, but that in sort of the longer view of things, they consider that it's a price worth paying. Also this week, we saw two rival groups of authors weighing in on opposite sides of the dispute. An author I'm not familiar with, but I guess he's pretty well known, Douglas Preston, wrote a letter to Jeff Bezos signed by 400 authors. It takes Amazon to task for its negotiating tactics with Hachette. Signers include Stephen King, James Patterson, and Robert Caro, the Johnson biographer. A rival initiative, launched as a petition at change.org, invites indie authors to join Hugh Howey and others in supporting Amazon against Hachette. Tonight, the number of signers on that petition totals 3,983. Howey's lengthy letter, I thought, was a masterful marshaling of facts and opinion, adding up to the assertion that Amazon has consistently taken actions that benefit authors and readers, while the same certainly cannot be said of Hachette and the Big Five publishers. So the beat goes on and on and on as Amazon and Hachette's negotiators, meeting at a hotel somewhere perhaps, attempt to reach an agreement. I think when I think about this story, when I had a job at a gas company, one year I was on the negotiating side for management, and the meter readers and a lot of the other folks that worked at the company were represented by union, and we had a company-wide negotiation. And it was fascinating. We were in a hotel in Nebraska, and the two sides would get together, and led by an attorney for the company and a really wily union official who was also an attorney, I think. And, you know, it was the art of trying to get to an agreement, and what happened in that room was very specific to those people and their negotiating. And we would hear rumbles from the outside of things that were going on to maybe affect what was going on in the room. And the union had a pretty fascinating ploy that sort of was a bit ominous. They had, on one morning of the negotiations, every district manager throughout the company, when he got to work, he found a rock on his desk. And then there was, the message was purportedly, the union is rock solid in its unanimity that it's on the terms that it's looking for from the company. Well, that's rock solid is great, but of course rocks can go through windows and do all kinds of things. And so it was kind of an ominous thing. So there was a rock in front of all of the company negotiators, as I remember, at this hotel. And you walk in, and we'd heard about the rocks, and there was a rock in front of each of our place on the desk. And it was a little tense, you know, and so the phone rang, and I picked it up, and I was kind of a young Turk at the time, and I just picked it up, and I said, "Rock Garden," and everybody laughed, and we sort of got past the rocks episode and started negotiating. So when I think of this Hachette-Amazon negotiation, I know somewhere there's some people that know each other, respect each other, very skilled at what they're doing, and they're trying to figure this thing out as this kind of rumble is taking place on the outside, which they can see in the newspaper articles or whatever. And it's just sort of a two-part drama, and the people who are really working on what's going to happen are doing it in ways that we just... Someday maybe we'll find out what happened and find out some stories about the negotiations, but until then it's all completely separate. As Amazon takes a more proactive stance to make its case and the sleeping giant of indie authors is roused to action, I kind of sense the tide turning on sort of this external drama that's accompanying the negotiations. There has been an odd silence recently from the main provocateur of the Hachette story, which was David Streitfeld of the New York Times. I keep hoping that he's going to get promoted to another beat, something easier, like maybe Congress. And there's some reason to believe, actually, there's going to be a change in the coverage of the Times, because Alexandra Alter, who's a digitally savvy reporter, has been lured away from the Wall Street Journal, and she's going to begin covering the publishing industry for the Times, I think, this week. And I think that can't help but improve the paper's coverage of Amazon and publishing, if that's the case. For the tech tip today, I came across a clever way to reduce the amount of time that you spend looking at the special offers on your Kindle Paperwhite, if that's a problem for you. Of course, you can just pay an extra $20 to remove special offers, but this method doesn't require paying any money. What you do is, instead of putting your Paperwhite to sleep when you're finished reading, you turn it off. Now, I have a cover on my Paperwhite, as does Darlene. I think probably a lot of Paperwhite owners have these magnetic covers that when you close it, it automatically puts the screen to sleep. And when you open it, you're going to see the offer, usually for a book that they're promoting, appear when you open the cover and turn the Kindle back on for reading. Then when you swipe to reveal your home screen, you're back at your list of books. So what you can do if you don't want to see that sleep screen offer is, before you close the cover of your Kindle, press the power button for about 5 seconds, and what you'll see is a dialog box that offers three options: cancel, restart, or screen off. If you tap screen off, the screen will turn gray with no images at all. Then when you close the cover, the next time you open it, you will see your home screen appear instead of that full screen special offer that appears if you close the cover without pressing the power button for 5 seconds and turning it off. There is a similar move to reduce the amount of promotions you look at, and it's available if you normally have your home screen in cover view. You know, there's list view and there's cover view. I usually use list view. I can see more books at a time. But if you have the cover view, you can go to settings from your home screen, then device options, personalize your Kindle, then turn off recommended content. When this setting is on, you're going to see a row of books covers beneath the first few books on your home screen, and they're going to offer books that Amazon's algorithms think you might be interested in buying. So if you turn off recommended content, you're just not going to see those recommended books. You still will see a thin banner ad at the bottom of the home screen, even if you take that off, and even if you turn your screen off instead of put it to sleep. The only way you can remove that banner is to change your status at Manage Your Device and Content page. That's at Amazon.com. And for the device, you go in and you unsubscribe from special offers, and that's what costs you $20. Because essentially, you pay $20 less by having the special offers, and at any time, you can change that back and forth to show them or not. Now, I offer these tips. I want to let you know I found them at a good site called ebookreader.com. There's also a video showing these tips and a couple of others. I'm passing this along not because I have anything against the special offers, but because I know not everyone loves them. I actually enjoy seeing them show up, and they, as I say, they usually are about books, and every once in a while I move to purchase what's being suggested, so I don't mind them at all. Another tech tip I'll mention this week is a way to get free Google Play apps onto your Kindle Fire. Now, I tried this on my HDX. I assume it works on the other versions of the Fire. I have, from time to time, tried methods of doing this, and they've always proved frustrating one way or the other. But this one, which I found at a blog by Rachel Bruner named lovemyfire.com, seems pretty solid. You have to sign up for the free newsletter to her blog in order to see this exclusive content, but it's, you know, that's easy to do, and I'm not sure how much she sends out from that newsletter. But once you've signed up for the newsletter, you can click on a clearly written and illustrated process that you can follow on your Kindle Fire itself. It relies on a website at apps.evozi.com, E-V-O-Z-I.com, and that's a site where you can paste the URL of a Google Play app, and then it generates a download link for the APK or Android app. I tried this with a podcasting app that I found at the Google Play Store named Player FM, nice clean app for listening to podcasts. It worked fine after I went through the process, except for one irritating little blip. When I tap on a podcast to play, a dialog box comes up asking that I get Google Play services. I think that's kind of a program that is part of the Google Play infrastructure. And so there's a statement that shows up on my screen saying, this app won't run without Google Play services, which are missing from your tablet. But all you have to do there is just tap on the link that says get Google Play services. You're not actually getting Google Play services by doing that, but it does make the dialogue disappear, and then you can play the podcast just fine. I think this method seems to be about as good as it gets if you have a Google Play app that you very much want to try running on your Kindle Fire. But these app stores still aren't meant to play nice with each other, and it's always pretty much a pain in the neck. Apple has the biggest store, of course, followed by Google's, but and then there's Amazon's. I think that the truth is that all three of them have the major apps that most people use, like Evernote and Skype and different apps that are just kind of common. I know that when I shift from my iPhone to the new Fire Phone, which I think is probably, I don't think I can carry around two smartphones with different numbers. So the thing that I will miss, I'm sure, is that there are apps on the iPhone system or the iTunes app store that I'm not going to be able to get on the Fire Phone. One I know for sure is that my bank has a nice app on the iPhone. It's also, I just checked, available on the Google Play Store, but it's not listed at apps for Android. So when I leave the big store, the Apple store, every once in a while I'm going to come up on with an app that I just can't get on my Fire Phone. I think some of the other things are going to make it worthwhile putting up with that inconvenience. David P. Vandegrift is an attorney whose blog, thepassivevoice.com, is a must-read resource for keeping on top of developments in indie publishing and the world of book publishing in general. I caught up with David by Skype at his hotel in New York City on Wednesday morning, July 2nd, just before he caught his flight back to Utah. And as I said, the night before, he had been one of seven people on a panel hosted by the New York Public Library titled Amazon Business as Usual? I began by asking David how this unusual event came about.
As far as I know, it was organized by the agent that was moderating it, and the way I got in was that I received a call from a friend that I've worked with and talked with at Amazon before, saying, "Hey, we're not going to be coming to this."
You laid it out clearly at the start of your comments that they had paid for your plane fare,
right?
And were there any other guidance from Amazon, or if they're paying for the plane fare, did they have any expectations that they articulated as to what you would say in New York?
None whatsoever.
Yeah.
Whatsoever. Just, this is what it's going to be. It's going to be, just a little bit of background, and we're not able to send anybody, or we don't want to send anybody. I don't recall which, quite frankly. You know, are you willing to go? And that was it. No instructions. No, you got to say this, don't say that, nothing like that.
Well, and you were one of, it was a big panel, seven members.
Yeah.
You mentioned the so-called moderator, Tina Bennett, who was a literary agent who seemed to become a fairly active participant in the
debate herself. What was your impression of the ground rules and the conduct of the forum?
Well, it's interesting. Somebody commented on my blog that the question was asked at the end of the forum, where was Amazon in this discussion? And the commenter said, the other question is, where was Hachette? There was no Hachette representative there either, although there was at least one in the audience. But I think the answer is, Amazon asked me to come and represent Amazon, and everybody else represented Hachette, essentially.
So in terms of the Amazon derangement syndrome, which you've mentioned, were there some who weren't completely coming from that place? Or
very much so. And I actually, on the blog, everybody wanted me to wear, I've got a t-shirt that has Amazon derangement syndrome with the, the circle with the red slash across it, and it's no Amazon derangement syndrome. And I decided that I wouldn't wear the t-shirt. I did have a sign there that said the same thing, but I was going to hold it up, but I decided that that might set off even more. It's very interesting. I mean, the Amazon that they see is just 180 degrees different than the Amazon that 99% of Amazon's customers see, and that the Amazon that indie authors see. It was just a very strange thing. I mean, Amazon is one of the, if not the most highly regarded brand in the United States, and these folks were into conspiracy theories and all sorts of strange behavior, and I got cut off when I was beginning to riff on that a little bit.
Now, you're sitting next to Morgan Entrekin, publisher and president of Grove Atlantic. At one point, I saw you listening to him pretty carefully and actually nodding your head. Did he seem like he had a little bit more of a nuanced view of Amazon's role in publishing and in this dispute?
Yeah, he did. I mean, he seemed reasonable and seemed like a nice guy, and he was not sort of spinning, well, I'll call them novel legal theories like the other two lawyers on the panel were about Amazon and about Amazon, what Amazon was doing. Yeah, it's very hard to be an indie press, small press these days, and I admire people that want to do that, and he, of all the people that were talking, seemed the most genuinely interested in the books and the quality of the books and even the authors of the books. And I did agree with some of the things that he was talking about.
Now, on the other end of the spectrum, you had James Patterson, who had some provocative comments at the beginning, at the end, but was largely silent through the conversation. What did you learn about him from sitting on the same stage with him yesterday evening?
Again, another comment on the blog I thought was appropriate. James is his own imprint, essentially. And so his experience with publishers and the experience of other authors with publishers are in two different universes. He has, and just so we're clear, I've never seen any of his contracts, but I think it's easy to say that he has contracts with his publishers that are completely different than the contracts the publishers offer to other authors. And so he sort of represents, in terms of the whole publishing spectrum, he represents himself and maybe, a half dozen of other, huge selling authors. And so from that standpoint, it's, I was surprised he didn't talk more. And he's been very vociferously anti-Amazon elsewhere, and I was surprised he didn't speak more during the discussion.
I've been curious just what accounts for his vociferous attacks. Is it because he's that position as kind of an imprint of one is particularly vulnerable to where Amazon is going, or is it more just some kind of psychological problem?
I think it's from a business standpoint. I think he is very closely tied. His success is very closely tied to the success of his publisher, in ways that differ from a normal author, regular author would have. And he's almost like a publisher himself, and I'm sure that his publisher treats him very well financially, which is not the case with all the authors that have contracts with big publishing.
There was a question from the audience. Someone asked, what would Amazon have to do to provoke or cause the federal government to launch an antitrust prosecution against the company? And I thought you as a lawyer might have had a shot at that question. But what's the answer to that question, if you'd had a chance to answer it?
Well, there was a lot of discussion on the part of one of the panelists about predatory pricing in Amazon. And I was going to jump into that, but I was afraid we'd drop into the lawyer weeds and everybody in the audience would check out. Basically, predatory pricing is an antitrust violation, but Supreme Court rulings have have said that the idea of predatory pricing is that you drive all of your competitors out of business by cutting your prices way low, and then once they're out of business, then you raise your prices. And the Supreme Court has said, you know, cutting prices is just fine. And if you're going to bring a predatory pricing antitrust action, you've got to show that the focus of that action actually increased prices. And Amazon hasn't done that and shows no signs of doing that. And predatory pricing has been claimed for Walmart as well. And Walmart has never done that. And so, the predatory pricing sounds good to people that don't really understand that law very well, but I don't see it anything in Amazon's behavior that would support that. I think a predatory pricing antitrust action would get kicked out of court, because where are the big price increases that Amazon is asking for? It's not. The antitrust laws are not designed to protect particular companies or particular groups of companies in a business. They're designed to protect competition and protect consumers. I think it's inarguable that consumers love Amazon and that Amazon treats consumers, its customers, extremely well. So that's a red herring that, you know, somebody, again, some of the lawyers on the panel certainly knew what it was, but in general, the publishers like to talk about predatory pricing without really understanding the law behind it.
There was one provocative charge made, I can't remember who it was, that when you search on Amazon, the results are skewed by payments that publishers, in this case, are paying to Amazon to have their books rise up in the search results. Is that true?
I don't think so. I mean, that's a bizarre claim, and that's something I've never heard anybody else say. And I didn't have a chance to really elaborate much, but Amazon's discoverability features for books include search, but they are way, there's much, much more going on there in their e-commerce platform than a simple, you know, search for this book and we'll show you something. And I've not experienced on my own in looking around Amazon, and certainly never heard this claim made before. The only entities that could possibly be paying for this, if it exists, would be the large publishers. And so I don't know how necessarily, you know, somebody who's on the side of large publishers is blaming Amazon if this is occurring for things that the publishers are paying them to do under this theory. Again, I'd be surprised, because Amazon is so focused on customer experience and customer satisfaction, I'd be very surprised if they were doing that. For Amazon, it's not worth it to them to have a poor customer experience. And certainly the publishers pay Barnes & Noble and other booksellers for placement of their books on the tables that the customers see when they walk in the door. That's well known, and you don't get on those tables unless you pay Barnes & Noble a lot of money. But Amazon is not a bookstore. It's a, you know, it's an everything store. And so the value of a customer to Amazon is not just for the books that customer buys, but everything that customer buys on Amazon. And so why in the world would they degrade the experience in any way, the customer experience, just for a payment from a publisher. I hadn't ever heard that before last night, and the more I thought about it, the less likely it seemed to me to be true. I just, you know, that just doesn't, that's not the way you run an e-commerce platform. You run an e-commerce platform to make it a great shopping experience and make it easy for people to find. The whole pay for position, is certainly a big publishing trope, but I don't think it works in Amazon's world.
Another idea that got some traction during the discussion, I think, from more than one of the speakers, was that books are not just commodities; they're something more precious to democracy, and that Amazon, by treating them as a commodity, just one thing they sell, is somehow threatening culture in a basic way that led to Patterson's kind of crazy comment about we're entering a new era of book burning. But is that distinction of books and the role they play in society, how does that fit into this whole discussion in your view?
You know, it's interesting. I'm sitting there last night wondering who's representing readers and who's thinking about readers in this. The whole idea that Amazon, you know, it's a terrible thing that Amazon is doing by pressuring the prices for books down so that more people can afford them, or avid readers can afford to buy more books, just didn't seem to have any credibility. There was a very clear tolerance of the idea that books should be more expensive and thus less available to certain segments of society. And so there's a very, and I sensed it last night, and I've sensed it before, there's a very elitist attitude that you have in the big publishing world, that we know what's best for the culture. You know, we're not the authors, not the readers, we're the guardians of the culture. And the whole baloney about we're the only ones that can make big books and important books and poetry and so forth happen. The unsaid part of that is that's why we don't pay authors more, because we have to take the money that we would pay for authors and put them into big books that won't make a profit. And the publishers do that only very rarely, if at all. And B, I'm always, a proponent that let the readers decide, let the readers vote with their dollars what they want. But in an elitist world that knows better about culture than the broader world, that sort of attitude doesn't fly.
You got cut off a number of times, and it was with seven people. It was just tough to get airtime. If you'd had a few minutes at the end of the discussion to make some points that you thought were important, what would you have said?
One thing that I wish I had an opportunity to explain is that the publishing world doesn't see and doesn't understand the self-publishing world, and it is by and large invisible, I think, to the publishing world. They know it's out there. They have a sense that it's threatening, and so they attack self-publishers and Amazon often in the same breath. But there was none of that last night. Self-publishing is a big business. You know, you add all of the self-published authors together, and according to author earnings, which is the only place that really is tracking in a systematic way self-published sales, right now the run rate is about $750 million a year going to self-published authors. And that self-published authors are making more on average per book, and this is in the best-selling area, the top 20 or 40,000 books on Amazon. They're making more money than the traditionally published authors are from their royalties. And so it's just, it really is two different worlds. And they kind of, me as sort of the representing, I was more representative of self-published authors than I was of Amazon last night. And it was just an interesting experience, because the sort of corporate attitude, the attitude that we've got to save these big corporations and the companies that own these big corporations through various types of legal maneuvers and through, you know, PR campaigns, trashing Amazon and so forth, was just worlds apart from how do we treat authors better? How do we get more books at prices that more readers can afford, which is the focus of a lot of the self-publishing discussions.
Yeah. Well, last question. There was some discussion of reconvening the event in the fall. If they do that, will you be willing to attend on the same basis?
I haven't decided. I think they need more balance in a future panel. I think they need to bring a successful self-published author on. Joe Conrath would have been great, on a panel. Hugh Howey would be terrific on the panel. But I think they need more balance, and quite frankly, I think they need fewer lawyers on it, and kind of fewer politicians. I didn't realize it, but someone commented on the blog that one of the attorney panelists was trying to run for lieutenant governor, you know, in New York, and would be happy to have the publisher's financial support behind him. And so, it needs to be a more balanced kind of a discussion, I think, and probably fewer people, but more opinions that weren't sort of down the corporatist party line.
I have been speaking with David P. Vandegrift, author of the Passive Voice blog at thepassivevoice.com. Thanks very much, David.
Thank you, Len.
In content, I finished Stephen King's new novel, Joyland, recently. Really enjoyed it. It's set in New Jersey at a family-owned amusement park. The story is rich with summer details, young love, and murder. This book generated some controversy among ebook fans because the publisher Hard Case Mysteries refused to release an ebook version of it when it first came out. They were making an aesthetic argument, as I remember, in that these covers are like hard-boiled paperback mysteries, so they wanted to kind of stick with that format. But eventually a Kindle version did come out, and it's a great read. At the end of it, it has a list of other Hard Case titles, and I think I'm going to just put a link to it up there because it looks like a good list. Blurbs are strong. One of them is blurbed actually by Stephen King, Songs of Innocence by Richard Alias. And then another one, actually the one that King blurred was The Comedy is Finished by Donald E. Westlake. But as you read the descriptions of these, they all look pretty good. And so if you like mysteries and you're looking for some titles this summer, I think that it might well be worth a look. That's it for this week. My guest next week will be David Rothman. He's the founder of the highly regarded Telereed website, which he ended up selling, and it now continues strong, covering one of the first people really covering ebooks as a beat. He's now deeply involved with issues facing public libraries, and I look forward to a wide-ranging conversation with him on Monday for next week's show. From time to time, I've asked you to consider making writing a review of the podcast at the iTunes store. That really helps out, I think, with discovery. And I've got some great reviews up there, but none too recently. So if you'd like to jump on and weigh in on the Kindle Chronicles in a way that might help other listeners find it, that would be much appreciated. The other thing is, I've got about 240 people signed up for the free email list for the show, and I put out every once in a while, you know, when something comes up, I'll send out an email to that list in addition to the weekly emails that I send out when the podcast is ready. So I try not to have it be something that, you know, you're really going to see a lot of it if you sign up for it, and you can easily unsubscribe if it turns out to be something that's not as much interest to you as you thought. But I would like to build that up, and so if you've been listening to the show and you're not on that email list, look to the right of the Kindle Chronicles.com page, and you'll see an easy sign up. All you have to do is enter your email address and your name, and then you'll receive those. Music for my podcast is from an original Thelonious Monk composition named Well You Needn't. This version, which I'm going to try performing by kazoo, is Ramonk by Yval Monegat on the Variations in Time, a Jazz Perspective CD by Public Transit Recording. This is Len Edgerly in Ocean Park, Maine, for the Kindle Chronicles. It is raining like a son of a gun out here. You probably can't hear it, but it's really a downpour. I really appreciate your taking the time to listen to my podcast. Have a great day. Bye.